attacking Miller take the state away from him? DeSalle was to describe the session as stormy and Bobby Kennedy as fierce. But at the end, the Kennedys had what they wanted. "What could I have done?" DeSalle was to tell friends. "Those Kennedys play real rough." Out beyond Ohio, in those crucial western states, Bobby worked on the men who held the pieces of power, turning into votes the friendships his brother Ted had made with them. Newspaper articles were beginning to appear about Bobby Kennedy now. In describing him, many of them used the same adjective, ruthless. Bobby hated that adjective. Men who dealt with him, however, did not feel it was inaccurate. Lyndon Johnson's supporters saw how much his wavering was hurting his chances. Rayburn told Johnson's aide Booth Mooney that he had tried to get Johnson to let it be known quietly, without any public announcement, that he would eventually become a candidate. That was the only way, the speaker said, to prevent men of power from lining up behind some other candidate. But Johnson still wouldn't allow that. His insistence on secrecy hamstrung Jenkins's organizing efforts. The Kennedy organization was extremely effective, George Reedy was to recall, and most of us really wanted to get out and counter. We thought it could be countered, despite the fact that he, Johnson, was a Southerner. After all, Kennedy was testing the old saw that a Catholic could not be president, and we saw no reason why we couldn't test the old saw that a Southerner couldn't be president, especially since this was a Southerner who actually managed to pass the first civil rights bills through the Congress in 82 years. We wanted to get out and really fight at it, but he would not permit us to do it. "We've had more trouble between us about this damn campaign than anything within my memory," Rayburn told Bobby Baker. "Lyndon's using his friends to raise money and court delegates, and he's making them, as well as himself, look silly." Silly. All through 1959, he wavered back and forth, until his wavering, his circling about the prize, his vacillation by a man usually so single-minded, tough, and decisive, contained elements not of failure alone, but of farce. A celebration he staged that year at the LBJ Ranch in honor of the President of Mexico, Adolfo López Mateos, was quite a spectacle. A fleet of 8 helicopters bearing, among others, Rayburn, Truman, Secretary of the Treasury Robert B. Anderson, and Texas Governor Price Daniel circled the ranch. When Mateos's helicopter touched down on the runway, a red carpet was rolled out to it, and the visitors were greeted by a large mariachi band. At lunch, as the 450 guests ate barbecue on the front lawn, the band played and there was a lasso-twirling exhibition by the gaily costumed Mexican Charro Association of San Antonio, while all during lunch on the far side of the little river, mounted cowboys herded longhorn cattle back and forth. The Dallas Morning News called the luncheon one of the most dramatic outdoor shows since they produced Aida with live elephants. And the most prominent decoration, looming over the guests while they ate, was a large brightly colored banner that had been hung from a branch of the big live oak tree in the ranch's front yard. Newsmen who had been assured by the ranch's owner, assured by him over and over in the most earnest of tones, that he was not a candidate for president, that he was not running for the job and didn't want it, arrived at the ranch to find the banner the owner had hung at his front door. "Lyndon Johnson será presidente." Despite his insistence that he wasn't a candidate, when someone took him at his word, his reaction was pique. Convinced by his assurances, 6 Washington journalists, writing a book of profiles on major candidates, hadn't included one on him, although Johnson had accepted an invitation to the book party. When, on the day of the party, he learned of his omission, he let it be known that he took it as a personal insult and refused to attend. Or the reaction was sulking. Asked by someone at his table at a White House dinner to list the leading Democratic candidates, President Eisenhower treated the matter as a joke, naming Rayburn and a number of Democratic senators who were obviously not candidates. Johnson, reading about this exchange in Drew Pearson's column, didn't take it as a joke at all. The next time he was in the White House at another social gathering, he sat pouting, as the president's diary was to relate, in almost complete silence. When Eisenhower, attempting to draw him out, asked him direct questions, he answered only in monosyllables. And when the next day Eisenhower telephoned with an apology, "Just kidding, this was all in the most laughing kind of thing," it took a while for Johnson to accept it. "I have no ambitions," he assured the president. "I'm not even going to the convention. At an appropriate time, I will tell them that. But I was distressed that the one whom I had admired and had attempted to cooperate with as much as I have..." Farce. Unless Lyndon Johnson in 1959 was viewed as a man throwing away his chance at the thing he had wanted all his life, in which case there were elements in the performance that might more aptly be fitted into a different theatrical genre. Tragedy. On the evening of December 7th, 1959, in New York City, the Democratic Party was turning out in force for a lavish dinner in honor of the idolized and influential Eleanor Roosevelt. Johnson, who had refused invitations to every other major Democratic event in this state he was counting on as a keystone in his presidential bid, was invited to give a short speech at this one, as were all the other leading candidates. Kennedy, Humphrey, Symington, even Adlai Stevenson, of course, accepted. Johnson declined. And then he accepted two other speaking invitations for the same date, one before a $15 per plate fundraising dinner sponsored by a Democratic club in a small town in Kansas, the other to a sewing bee in a small town in Iowa. "As usual," James Reston wrote in the New York Times, "these moves by the Democratic majority leader are a mystery to friend and foe alike. Even his enthusiastic supporters cannot make sense out of these decisions." What made them even more senseless to those rooting for Lyndon Johnson was another demonstration of what might have been. Following his speech in Kansas, a Times reporter asked one of the guests, "Would you vote for a Southerner?" "I didn't think of it in that way when he was speaking," the man replied. The targets of his fearsome rages had always been men and women at whom they could be directed with impunity, subordinates who had no choice if they wanted to keep their jobs, but to accept his tongue-lashings, junior senators who, needing his favor, also had no choice. With men he needed, there was not rage, but only humility, deference. With Herman Brown of Brown and Root, or the old Senate bulls, whose support was still essential to him, he had always been as obsequious as he was overbearing with others. Now, so intense was the conflict within him, that it exploded as well against men he needed, at least once in a way very damaging to his hopes. Trying to decide whom to support, California Governor Pat Brown, whose state was very much up for grabs, flew across the country to Washington in 1959 to evaluate the candidates and, accompanied by his aide, Fred Dutton, met with Johnson in the Taj Mahal. The meeting went on far longer than Brown had expected, 90 minutes, and, as Brown later related, "Senator Johnson did all the talking," explaining, among other things, many other things, why he was not electable. For the first half hour, Brown was to say, he was rather impressed. During the second half hour, he was not so impressed. And then, as the meeting entered its third half hour, Brown, perhaps trying merely to get in a word or two, used the wrong one, saying that he agreed that Northern hostility made Johnson not electable. Johnson's reaction astonished Dutton. "Brown was a governor, and here Johnson was just tongue-lashing him," he says. "He towered. His desk was higher. It was on a platform. 'Don't you ever say I'm not electable. What do you know about national politics?'" The reaction cost Johnson any chance of Brown's support. The governor, who was to tell a friend that during the third half hour he became downright angry, didn't respond at the time. "It just wasn't in Pat Brown's nature to answer back," Dutton says. "He responded on national television, in a particularly effective way, using an appearance on Face the Nation to spotlight the issues most damaging to Johnson, saying that California probably would not vote for him because of his associations with the South and the oil interests." Late in the year, trying to solve what Look magazine called the number one enigma of United States politics, Jack Kennedy dispatched Robert to the Johnson Ranch to decipher his intentions face to face. The trip did little to ease the tension between the two men. There was a deer hunting trip. Bobby didn't want to go, but Johnson insisted. and when Bobby fired the powerful shotgun he had been given, instead of the rifle customary on deer hunts, the unexpected force of its recoil knocked him to the ground. Helping him to his feet, Johnson said, "Son, you've got to learn to handle a gun like a man." Nor did it do much to solve the enigma. Assuring Bobby that he had decided not to run and to stay neutral as the other candidates fought it out, Johnson made these statements so convincingly that Bobby returned north to tell his brother that Johnson probably wasn't running. While Bobby had been in Texas, however, an interview with Johnson had appeared in the Christian Science Monitor. To the interviewer's inquiry about the burgeoning number of Johnson for President clubs, he had replied, "I hear what some of my friends are doing, and I see what they are doing. The people usually have a way of selecting the person they think best qualified." The strongest public indication he had yet given that he was running. Then there was an interview in Time magazine. "I am not a candidate, and I do not intend to be," Lyndon Johnson said. Soon thereafter, Jack Kennedy found himself on a train from New York to Washington with Texas reporter Leslie Carpenter, and Carpenter was to say, "Kennedy spent the whole time trying to find out what I knew about whether Lyndon Johnson was actually going to be more than a favorite son candidate." Kennedy remained puzzled. He was sure that Lyndon Johnson was running, but how could he be running if he was acting like this? Then it was 1960. If he wanted to reach for the prize, he couldn't wait any longer. Within Lyndon Johnson's inner circle, there was no longer any pretense that he wasn't running. He had persuaded Sid Richardson to lend John Connolly to him for the campaign. He considered that very important. He felt, Busby says, that Connolly was the only man tough enough to handle Bobby Kennedy. And John was directing the work of a full-scale national campaign headquarters. A 12-room operation in an Austin hotel with 14 paid staff members and scores of volunteer workers. Walter Jenkins was organizing new Johnson for President clubs every day. By the end of January, they would be operating in 27 states. Speechwriters were being hired. Theodore H. White was one of those recommended, but White said he was going to be working on a book in 1960. A score of surrogates were fanning out across the country, talking up his candidacy before local Democratic groups, and thanks to Rayburn, they were very well-connected surrogates. Oscar Chapman, former Secretary of the Interior, for example, and India Edwards, a one-time vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee. In 1959, Jack Kennedy had sent an emissary to ask Mrs. Edwards, in her words, what it would take to get me on his bandwagon, and she had refused, feeling he was too young and inexperienced. But when Sam Rayburn asked her to work for Johnson, of course, she accepted. And all these operations were funded with a lavishness awesome to anyone not familiar with the scale and casualness of campaign financing Texas style. "I have some money that I want to know what to do with," George Brown said in a call to Johnson's office on January 5th. "I will be collecting more from time to time." He collected a lot more. Envelopes stuffed with cash cascaded up to Washington, for the other Texas oil men were aboard. Booth Mooney had left Johnson's staff to work for oil man H.L. Hunt, and he was to relate, "Twice I personally carried packets of $100 bills, the common currency of politics, to Jenkins." On the eve of the new year, at the end of December 1959, Lyndon Johnson convened a meeting at the ranch to begin a drive to capture those 10 western states that were the key to his plan. There was a lot of power at that meeting. Mike Kirwan, a senior member of the House Appropriations Subcommittee that approved or disapproved Western Public Works projects, Governor Buford Ellington of Tennessee, a couple of Western senators, Bobby Baker, the man who knew where all the bodies were buried, as well as the right guy to scout the Western political landscape, Irvin Hoff, Washington Senator Warren Magnuson's administrative assistant, who had been loaned to Johnson because of the expertise he had demonstrated while running senatorial campaigns in several Western states. When, however, just after the first of the year, Hoff headed into the West, he found that, "Wherever I went, Bobby Kennedy had been there." "He was easy to track, and the tracks were everywhere," Hoff says. And whatever Bobby had done to tie delegates to the Kennedys, he had been very effective. People who would normally have been with Johnson had been approached 6 months earlier and had already had the halter and bridle. By the time I got there, it was already too late. In every state that Hoff visited, a smoothly functioning Kennedy organization had been in place for some time. When Hoff asked Larry Jones in Johnson's Austin headquarters about their own Western organizations, the report was clear. We have no organization in the state of Montana, either contacting potential delegates or delegates, nor do we have an organization building popular support. We have no organization in the state of Idaho. Even as Hoff was traveling, Johnson organizations were being set up, but it was too late. Rose warning 2 years earlier that ignoring the Western delegates could be disastrous had been borne out. Johnson's headquarters was sending the new organization's crates of buttons bearing the legend, All the Way with LBJ. Hoff telephoned Austin to say it would be necessary to design a different button. Many people do not know what LBJ means. The accuracy of Rose's prediction struck George Reedy at about the same time. While Johnson was still refusing to leave Washington on days when the Senate was actually meeting, quick weekend trips, in a specially equipped twin-engine Convair that Johnson had leased for the campaign, were possible, and the first of those trips was to Wyoming, a state Reedy and Johnson had believed bore the LBJ brand. That belief didn't last even as long as it took Reedy to get out of the Cheyenne airport. Piling into a car along with several Washington newsmen to follow Johnson to the hotel at which he was to speak, Reedy found himself sitting next to a man he didn't know. One of the reporters asked the man whom Wyoming would be supporting at the convention. "Oh, Kennedy," the man replied matter-of-factly. Startled, Reedy asked the reason. "He's the only one who's been out here and asked us for our vote," the man said. The man turned out to be Tenno Roncalio, chairman of Wyoming's Democratic Party. Reedy had never heard his name, but learned that his preference was quite firm. Wyoming was a state that Lyndon Johnson should have had. We would have had, if we had merely done some organization work in it a few months earlier, Reedy was to say. Johnson's fear of trying had held him back until now, and now it was too late. In addition, while he was at last actively planning his campaign within his inner circle, outside that circle, he was still refusing even to acknowledge that he would one day become a candidate. His public refusals might be laid to the fact that by saying, so often and so convincingly, that his Senate responsibilities were his first priority, he had trapped himself. With the Senate still in session, how could he openly run for president? But that explanation doesn't make clear why he didn't say, wouldn't say, adamantly refused to let his representatives like Irv Hoff say, even in private, that he would announce his candidacy after the Senate adjourned. And he wouldn't say that or let men like Hoff say it, not even in private, not even in the West, where he had to have delegates if he was to stop Kennedy, not even to men in the West who, if he didn't say it, would, with the time before the convention growing short, align themselves irrevocably to another candidate. Despite the Kennedys' activities, there was still solid Johnson sentiment in the West, but politicians there had to be assured that the sentiment would be requited. They're a pretty cagey bunch of guys out there, and they're not going to support someone who maybe won't run. And then they've alienated the guy who was going to win, Hoff said. It was pretty hard to sell a guy if all you could say was, maybe he's going to run. Flying back to Washington, Hoff told Johnson that he had to give Western delegates at least an assurance that while he was not announcing at the moment, he would eventually do so. I said, Senator, I've got nothing to sell. The media out there all want to know if you're running. What can I tell them? He said, Irv, I'm not at this point saying. I have 10 bills I have to pass here. At one point, Hoff thought that he had made Johnson understand. In Idaho, where the Hell's Canyon Dam was rising day by day and where political leaders knew who had gotten them the dam at last, the Democratic state chairman, Tom Boise, had told Hoff that despite all the Kennedy efforts, many party leaders were still considering supporting Johnson. These guys were for Johnson, Hoff says. If we had been able to tell them that he was going to run, we'd have had that delegation. He explained this to Johnson, and Johnson accepted an invitation to speak in Lewiston, Idaho, and afterwards to have a drink with Boise and his leaders in a hotel suite. But in the suite, Johnson said all the right things, except the one thing it was necessary for him to say. Lady Bird had gone to bed in another room, and he was in his living room, walking around in his pajamas holding a drink, stirring it with his big finger. They said, "We're for you, but we need to know if you're going to run." He said, "What the hell do you think I'm out here for, catching butterflies? Do you see me carrying a net?" But there were future government positions at stake, careers at stake, issues at stake. With the convention so close, rhetorical humor wasn't enough. They pressed him further. But all Johnson would say was, "I'll let you know. You'll be the first to know." Recalling the scene years later, Hoff would say, "It was like he couldn't bring himself to say it. He had flown out there to say it, but he couldn't bring himself to get the words out." Witnessing similar scenes, Bobby Baker felt he understood them, that the problem was LBJ's fear of being defeated, that saying it would be admitting that he was trying, and trying might mean failing, so he couldn't bring himself to say it. After Johnson had gone to bed, Boise told Hoff quietly that Johnson's assurances had not been adequate. He said, "We've got to know, and we've got to know pretty soon. I'm for him 100%, but we've got to know." Hoff understood, but when he raised the subject the next day, Johnson again refused to authorize him to give Boise any firm assurance. And at least Johnson was willing to go to Idaho, where people were friendly. To any suggestion that he visit a state where his reception would be problematical, he was still shying away, quite violently. There was a hint of desperation now in the telephone calls that Walter Jenkins was receiving from California. An opening, an 81-vote opening, was ready to be exploited there, he was told. Pat Brown's attempt to keep his delegation uncommitted until he could decide on a candidate was falling apart, and despite the governor's hostility to Johnson, if I could bring Lyndon in contact with the delegates themselves, he would own them like he does everybody he meets, Judge Walter Ely told Jenkins on January 25th. The old problem remained, however. Among the key California Democrats favorably disposed toward Johnson was the delegation's vice chairman, Clinton D. McKinnon. "I asked him if he would help," Leonard Marks reported to Jenkins. "He says he can't make a commitment until he knows for sure that Johnson is a candidate. He says when I ask him to help Johnson, I am talking about some very practical things in his life, and something that might affect his future, so he wants to make sure he is a candidate." Yet Johnson wouldn't even visit California, after first accepting and then declining a number of speaking engagements there in January. He repeated that performance in February. At the end of March, Hoff, who had been touring California sounding out individual delegates, sent Jenkins two memos telling him that although Johnson hadn't even set foot in California for too many years, he still had a chance to win a substantial number of delegates there. "The California delegation is far from being committed to anyone," Hoff said. "Kennedy may have a few more commitments than anyone else, but all the delegates are very friendly to Johnson." But Hoff said, "If he is going to get any place in this delegation, he has just got to come out here." There was simply no alternative. "They all know who he is, but don't know him. You can't turn the Johnson sentiment into solid support without Johnson coming out." Johnson then agreed to go during the Senate's Easter recess, and Bobby Baker told Ely to arrange a statewide tour, saying, "I can practically guarantee you he will be there." The guarantee proved worthless, however. At the last minute, Bobby had to tell Ely that the senator is disinclined to come. In desperation, Ely tried to telephone Johnson directly. Johnson refused to take the call. Phoning Jenkins, Ely said that many of the delegates were saying of Johnson, "Oh, he is the best man, but he is not a real candidate." "Hell, Walter, he either wants it or he doesn't," Ely said, "and he has never even been out here to make a speech. Walter, he simply must let people see him. It is when they meet him and shake his hand that they are won over. I just don't believe he can do it unless he comes. There comes a time when you can't just continue to keep fighting for a phantom." To make matters worse, civil rights came up again. The assurance Johnson had given liberals to persuade them to support the weak 1957 Act, that it would be quickly amended to strengthen it, "Don't worry, we'll do it again in a couple of years," had not been redeemed in 1958 or 1959. In 59, in fact, Johnson's power had been the principal obstacle. Emboldened by the 1958 elections, which had given liberals an overwhelming 2-1, 64-34 majority in the Senate, liberal senators moved to amend Rule 22, the filibuster rule that ensured the tactic's effectiveness. Johnson placed himself in their path. "Jesus, it was rough," recalled one of them. Johnson was going around with two lists in his inside pocket. One was for committee assignments and anything else you wanted, and the other was for Rule 22. He didn't talk about the first until you'd cleared on the second, and that was all there was to it. With no new legislation to strengthen the Civil Rights Bill in 1958 or 1959, he had to produce some in 1960 if he was to reduce the hostility of Northern Convention delegates. Liberals were insisting now on the part of the 1957 bill that had been cut out, Part 3, the section that would ban segregation in public venues such as theaters, restaurants, hotels, buses, and trains, and in schools, where, 6 years after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, only a tiny percentage of black children were going to school with white children in the South. Without enactment of Part 3, the federal government would still have in effect done nothing about the most painful injustices to which millions of American citizens were subjected because of their race. Johnson had hoped that Richard Russell, understanding Johnson's need to placate liberals, would compromise as he had done in 57, but as I have written, however much affection Russell might feel for Lyndon Johnson, the overriding reason that Russell wanted him to become president was to protect the interests of the South. When Johnson's interests collided with those interests, it was the South's, not Johnson's, that would be protected. And to Russell, Part 3, in any form, struck at the heart of the Southern way of life. By banning segregation in social settings, it would, Russell felt, inevitably lead to what was for the Georgian the horror of horrors, what he called the mongrelization of the noble white race. When, in January 1960, Johnson tried to explain that he had no choice but to bring a civil rights bill to the floor, Russell, cool and aloof, said, "Yes, I understand that you let them jockey you into that position. I understand." A Johnson proposal to bypass the Southern-controlled Judiciary Committee and bring the bill to the floor by adding its provisions to a House measure on an unrelated topic caused the first rupture in the 11-year alliance of the two legislative titans. Russell called the move a lynching of orderly procedure in the Senate. Johnson's angry response, that this was the only kind of lynching he had ever heard Russell object to, was blurted out only in private, to two staffers in his limousine. Johnson had had no choice but to repair the breach. Though he made a show of attempting to break a Russell-led Southern filibuster with around-the-clock sessions, veteran Senate observers saw that it was all a charade, a cozy and often rather jolly affair. "Bonhomie has been rampant," one was to write. "The Senate has never seemed more like a gentleman's club." Never had the South's power been more clearly demonstrated than in the 55-42 vote against cloture. Not only had liberals been unable to muster the necessary two-thirds vote, they hadn't even been able to get a majority. Working with Eisenhower's Attorney General, William P. Rogers, Johnson then watered down Part 3 until by the time it passed, little remained but an amendment that supposedly strengthened the voting rights provisions of the 1957 bill, but from the start proved next to worthless. Although Russell made a show of dismay at the bill's passage, it was, Jacob Javits of New York said, a victory for the Old South. Accusing Johnson of collaborating with Russell to reduce the measure to only a pale ghost of our hopes of last fall, Pennsylvania's Joseph Clark turned to the Southern leaders on the Senate floor and said, "The roles of Grant and Lee at Appomattox have been reversed. Dick, here is my sword. I hope you will give it back to me so that I can beat it into a plowshare for the spring planting." Having given it what it wanted, a civil rights bill so weak as to be virtually no bill at all, Johnson got the South back, from Russell and the Southern senators down to the man in the street. A Gallup poll showed Johnson with a wide edge, 35% to 20% for Kennedy, the runner-up, in the former Confederate states. Liberal magazines and newspapers, on the other hand, with the notable exception of Philip Graham's Washington Post, found in the Week Bill confirmation of their long-held suspicions about him. Even in the earlier stages of the 1960 fight, before his alliance with the South had become obvious, the issue had hurt him with liberals. On March 6th, before his statement against the original Part 3, at a point where he was still ostensibly fighting for a strong bill, James Reston reported that he had nonetheless lost support in the North. "The explanation of this odd paradox," Reston said, "is that the debate, accompanied by demonstrations against segregated restaurants in the South, has dramatized the race issue and evidently convinced the Democratic politicians in the large northern cities that a Texan, even one responsible for putting over a good civil rights bill, would not be a popular candidate in the urban North. And when, a few days later, it became apparent that the bill Lyndon Johnson was putting over was not at all a good bill, liberal distrust of him was back, stronger than ever. Joseph L. Rao, Jr., probably the single most influential figure in the civil rights camp, former chairman of both Americans for Democratic Action and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and chief counsel of the United Automobile Workers, had in 1957 hated his guts for what he was doing for school desegregation. That was a crime against the Negroes when Lyndon Johnson knocked out Part 3. He had nonetheless persuaded other civil rights leaders to support the bill, partly because it was important to show that a civil rights bill could be passed, and largely because of Johnson's promises to revisit and amend it. Now he hated his guts more than ever, if possible. The 1960 bill, Rao says, was a pile of rubbish and garbage disguised as a statute. It was a joke, he says. Everybody knew it was a joke. Nobody who was really for civil rights then could have supported it, much less have pushed it through the Senate. And Johnson was not really for civil rights, Rao felt. Not that he was against civil rights. He was simply for anything on either side that would help him become president. It wasn't that he was a conservative or a radical or anything else. It was simply that he was trying to be all things to all people. The revered liberal Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois went further. Johnson had remained at least ostensibly neutral in the cloture fight only because he had known the South would win, Douglas said. Had the results been in doubt, Johnson would have thrown his full weight behind the filibuster. Liberal opinion was hardening. Johnson rejected, said the ADA world, making clear that what Johnson was being rejected for was the Democratic nomination. The article quoted a liberal congressman who said, ADA, union officials and colored leaders may not have the votes to put a presidential candidate across at the convention, but they sure have the votes to block a man. On May 29th, speaking before the American Jewish Congress, Roy Wilkins, executive secretary of the NAACP, praised the civil rights record of Nixon and all the senator candidates for the presidential nomination, except Senator Lyndon B. Johnson. Lyndon Johnson might have been able to blunt at least the sharpest edges of the suspicions of blacks and liberals, to emphasize that, however weak the 1957 Civil Rights Act might be, its very passage was an historic achievement, and it was he who had gotten it passed, to explain that voting was indeed the most important right, to sell them on the idea that he had done all that he could and would eventually, as soon as possible, do more. Men and women who had watched him sell that idea in Washington felt he could have sold it anywhere, but it was a very difficult sale, and no one could make it for him. The proof of that came in his attempts to let others make it for him, in his decision to stay in Washington instead of traveling to northern states and explaining his civil rights stance in person. Trying to persuade black political leaders in Detroit to withdraw their opposition to his candidacy, Johnson asked Hobart Taylor, a young black assistant district attorney in that city whose father was a longtime Johnson ally in Texas, to invite the leaders to meet not with Johnson but with four of his Texas surrogates. The room full of black faces and southern accents must have made an interesting scene. And although young Taylor was a popular figure and the Texans did their best, they weren't Lyndon Johnson. After the meeting, one of the leaders told a reporter that they tried to convince us that Senator Johnson was a friend of the Negro, and was trying to help them to the best of his ability. We were told that if we withdrew our opposition as a race, it would help Johnson's campaign and would help us. We were not convinced. Another said simply, "They are wasting their time." And it wasn't just Northern blacks whom Lyndon Johnson was failing to placate on the civil rights issue. He wasn't doing any better in the North with whites, as India Edwards was finding out. I talked to the Northern delegations, and that was some experience, she was to recall. At a meeting of the Minnesota delegation, they laughed at me. When I began telling them that Lyndon Johnson would be a liberal president, well, the delegates just put their heads back and screeched. It was the funniest thing they ever heard. After another discussion in Detroit, this one on March 28th in a hotel room, David S. Broder, a young reporter from the Washington Evening Star who had been allowed to attend on condition that he not identify the participants, felt that he understood the problem, that Johnson hadn't come to Detroit himself. The discussion took place after the annual dinner of the Democratic Midwest Conference, which had been attended by three of the four invited speakers, Kennedy, Humphrey, and Symington, but of course not by Johnson. For hours, a Johnson aide tried to persuade two key Michigan politicians, one a high-level aide to Governor Williams, to support Johnson, with a lack of success so total that, in Broder's words, the participants were on the verge of exhaustion and tears. The coolness toward Senator Johnson rests not on what he has done, but on what he has not done, Broder wrote. He has not taken the Michigan Democrats into his confidence and made them feel they have a part in his efforts. For all their carping about his compromises, Michigan Democrats, whose own governor has faced a Republican legislature for 12 years, have an underlying sympathy for the frustrations that beset a leader facing a Senate with such a powerful conservative wing. If Senator Johnson had visited the state, they would have been reminded of these facts. Had he done so, and explained the facts to Michigan Democrats, as Broder had watched him do with such success in Washington, to so many groups of varying political sympathies, they would have seen what larger purpose animates Senator Johnson's technical maneuvers. But nothing but such a visit and such discussions would help, Broder explained. So long as he leaves them in ignorance, they find it easy to accept the popular liberal characterization of him as a representative of a Texas dominated by segregationists and oil barons. The Johnson aide had given the standard explanation for his absence, that the majority leader would have neglected his duties had he come to Detroit. That argument might be valid, Broder wrote, but unless Senator Johnson can find some means of communicating directly with his fellow Democrats, in states such as Michigan, it is difficult to see how he can satisfy the ambition no one doubts he harbors. Broder's belief in Johnson's ability to win over even blacks suspicious of him if only he communicated with them directly was validated during a long plane flight in 1960, for on that flight he communicated with one man quite directly. The man was Howard B. Woods, the editor of a black newspaper, the St. Louis Argus, and his presence aboard Johnson's convair was the outgrowth of a conversation between Johnson and one of his largest campaign contributors, August Bush, owner of the Anheuser-Busch Company, during a visit to Bush's country home outside St. Louis. When Johnson began complaining about how blacks didn't appreciate or apparently even know about his accomplishments in civil rights, Bush telephoned Alfred Fleischman, a St. Louis public relations man, and put Johnson on the line. When Johnson told Fleischman that if he could only dispel the image that he was an anti-civil rights Southerner, lightning might strike at the convention, Fleischman suggested that he allow himself to be interviewed by Woods, and a week or two later the short, bespectacled editor found himself on Johnson's convair. Lady Bird and Lucy Baines were aboard, and his secretary, Mary Margaret Wiley, and several Texans. And Woods was made uneasy at first by what he was to describe as a cabin filled with yards and yards of honey-coated Southern drawl. But all his misgivings vanished after Johnson came over and sat down facing him across a narrow table. The senator, tieless and in shirt sleeves, was eating cookies and drinking a tall and stiff scotch, But when Woods asked him about the Civil Rights Bill, which seems to please no one, saying, "Senator, the bill, as it was finally passed, was admittedly watered down," Johnson forgot about the cookies and the scotch and leaned forward across the table, looking Woods straight in the eye in a way the editor found quite memorable. "When we say every man has a right to vote, that is not watered down," Lyndon Johnson said. "The important thing in this country is whether or not a man can participate in the management of his government. When this is possible, he can decide that I'm no good." George Reedy slipped into the seat next to Woods, but Johnson didn't need Reedy now. "Civil rights are a matter of human dignity," he said. "It is outrageous that all people do not have the dignity to which they are entitled, but we can't legislate human dignity. We can legislate to give a man a vote and a voice in his own government. Then, with his vote and his voice, he is equipped with a very potent weapon to guarantee his own dignity." Johnson continued talking for quite some time, Woods was to write, and he does not exude at all the craftiness and cunning attributed to him. Rather, he is homespun, warm, and utterly convincing. "You ask me if I'm a Southerner or a Westerner," he said to Woods at one point. "I don't think it makes any difference." And he said it didn't matter if he was a Protestant or a Catholic or a Jew, white or colored. "I am an American." A man's religion didn't matter, shouldn't matter, Lyndon Johnson said, and neither did the region of the country he came from. "What is the difference if it's LBP or LBW, Lyndon B. Protestant or Lyndon B. Westerner?" "And a man's color shouldn't matter either," he said, and extending his huge hand across the table, he took Wood's hand in his and stroked it, vigorously in Wood's terms, as if to rub its color off. The more trips Lyndon Johnson took into the North, the more black people who actually got to meet him, the better it will be for him, Woods wrote. His refusal to admit that he was a candidate was still leading to scenes that would have been funny, except to those who, like Sam Rayburn, saw him throwing away his great chance at the prize he had worked for so long and so hard. "Horace, what's wrong with him?" the speaker asked Busby once. One of these scenes took place at a busy Washington intersection. National campaign headquarters were being set up on the entire mezzanine floor of the Ambassador Hotel at the corner of 14th and K Streets. Furniture had been rented, telephone lines were being installed, but the existence of a campaign headquarters was proof that there was a campaign, so even while Johnson was staffing it himself, personally giving out assignments, he wanted its existence kept secret. And then suddenly there was a story about it in Sarah McClendon's column. "Who told her this?" Johnson screamed. At first, recalls Ashton Ganella, one of his secretaries, he blamed Bobby Baker. "Boy, that office better be closed by tonight. You're trying to ruin me." He pinned him up against a wall. "I didn't give you permission." When Johnson was very upset, he would pace back and forth with lunging, somewhat awkward strides, making gestures with his long arms so frenetic that Marie Famer calls them flailing, and he was pacing and flailing now. He ordered Connolly to find out where McClendon had gotten her information, and finally ascertained that one of his own lawyers, Leonard Marks, had let something slip while chatting with her at a cocktail party. And then, 5 days later, embarrassment escalated. Baker had indeed closed the office, the furniture and telephones had been removed, but someone had forgotten that large signs, one for the K Street side of the Ambassador, one for the 14th Street side, each proclaiming in huge letters, "National Headquarters, Lyndon B. Johnson for President Citizens Committee," had been ordered. No one had canceled the order. All at once reporters were calling, and Johnson's horrified staff learned that the signs were being hoisted into place at that very moment, and the television crews had arrived, along with newspaper photographers. Telephoning the sign company, Jenkins demanded that the signs be taken down immediately, but when workmen started to do so, it turned out that while the company had a permit to erect the signs, a different permit was required to remove them. A patrolman ordered the workmen to stop, and when they tried to go ahead anyway, the patrolman called for backup, and a patrol car arrived. It took 2 hours for that matter to be resolved, and for the signs to come down, and there were photographs in Washington newspapers the next day, and headlines like the one in the Post. Premature boom, a dud. Johnson for president signs go up, then down in Texas-sized faux pas. Then in March, Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion visited the United States. New York attorney Edwin Weissel, a major financial supporter of both Israel and Johnson, had arranged for the two men to meet in New York. Saying that the meeting would make him look like a candidate, Johnson backed out at the last moment, however, and wouldn't meet with the prime minister in public even when Ben-Gurion came to Washington. Johnson was finally taken secretly, without reporters being informed, to talk with Ben-Gurion at Abe Fortas's Georgetown home. Telephoning Jenkins, the economist Elliot Janeway, a Weissel friend and another longtime Johnson ally in New York, told him that Johnson's actions made no sense. Why didn't he publicize it? He asked. He is his own principal source of defeat. He makes the stories to flog him with, Janeway told Jenkins. The nomination wasn't going to be won as an inside job. He better come out and be a candidate. You ought to call off this cloak and dagger business. They are all laughing at Johnson. And in fact, they were. Journalists, politicians, his own supporters. Their puzzlement over his tactics was turning to ridicule. Even Charlie Herring, loyalist of the loyal followers of his standard through so many campaigns, was losing faith. We do have a candidate, don't we? He asked Jenkins in a call on March 23rd. He isn't going to run out on us, is he? I wear the chain I forged in life, Marley's ghost admits to Ebenezer Scrooge. I made it link by link. During the early months of 1960, Lyndon Johnson was forging, link by link, his own chain, and it was a heavy one. Humiliation had always been what he most feared. During these months, again and again, through his own actions, he was bringing upon himself what he most feared. His last-ditch attempt to reach for the prize was being hamstrung as well by another aspect of his personality. When Lyndon Johnson was fighting hard for something, and he was fighting hard now, even if only behind the scenes, it was like the old days, Ed Clark says, I could set my watch by getting a call from him at 6 o'clock in the morning. An aspect of the determination he always displayed during such efforts was conviction, a seemingly total belief in what he was fighting for. He felt that victory required belief. As a boy, friends recall, he was always repeating the salesman's credo that you've got to believe in what you're selling. Decades later, in his retirement, he would say, what convinces is conviction. You simply have to believe in the argument you are advancing. If you don't, you're as good as dead. The other person will sense that something isn't there. And Lyndon Johnson could make himself believe in an argument even if that argument did not accord with the facts, even if it was clearly in conflict with reality. He would quickly come to believe what he was saying, even if it was clearly not true, his aide Joseph Califano would write. It was not an act, George Reedy would say. He had a fantastic capacity to persuade himself that the truth, which was convenient for the present, was the truth, and that anything that conflicted with it was the prevarication of enemies. He literally willed what was in his mind to become reality. He would refuse to hear any facts which conflicted with that reality, to listen to anyone who disagreed with him. His oldest Texas associates, men like Clark, called the process the revving up or the working up, explaining, he could start talking about something and convince himself it was right and true, even if it wasn't. The argument Johnson was advancing now was that Kennedy, needing to win on the first ballot if he was to win at all, would not be able to win enough primaries or enough delegates to win on that ballot, and he had convinced himself of that so completely that he discounted any suggestion to the contrary. James C. Wright, a third-term congressman from Fort Worth, had long been a true believer in Lyndon Johnson's political acumen. I was one of his eager disciples during the 1960 campaign, he was to say. But now Johnson sent him to speak on his behalf at the state convention of the Kansas Democratic Party. It had been agreed that each speaker would talk for about 20 minutes, and Wright had spoken for that length of time, as had Hubert Humphrey. And then, Wright was to recall, he saw Jack Kennedy speak for the first time. He spoke for about 8 minutes, and that was all he needed. When he sat down, he had that crowd in the palm of his hand. He had the gift of leaving them wanting more. I saw the Kennedy magic then that I had not really appreciated. Feeling that Johnson had not sufficiently appreciated the impact that Kennedy was making, when I got back to Washington, I asked to see Lyndon, and I told him I thought he should get out on the hustings more. But, Wright says, he rejected my suggestion. The reason Johnson gave, Wright says, was that I've committed myself to remain in Washington doing his Senate work, but the real reason was that he just didn't believe Wright's assessment of Kennedy's effectiveness as a speaker. He thought I had been overly impressed by Kennedy. For the first time, the eager disciple began to doubt. I wondered when I left Johnson's office if Lyndon was taking that seriously enough. He refused to hear anything he didn't want to hear. When his longtime ally Richard Berlin, publisher of the Hearst newspapers, tried to tell him that he was losing his chance in California, he just pooh-poohed the idea, as Berlin said in a telephone call to Jenkins. You know Lyndon, he believes what he wants to believe. At a meeting where he was receiving reports from his emissaries to the western states, the man responsible for Wyoming began saying that Jack Kennedy had Wyoming locked up. Johnson cut him off. Next, he said curtly. Later, Johnson told Walter Jenkins the man was a defeatist, and soon he was no longer on the payroll. Consequently, fewer and fewer people who had Johnson's ear told him the truth as they saw it. Men who did not know Johnson as well as Wright or Berlin, and who were aware of the steadily rising total of Kennedy delegates, were startled by the strength of his conviction. Johnson asked a young congressman, Thomas P. O'Neill, Jr. of Massachusetts, if he could come by O'Neill's office. There was no more making men come to him now, not if they could help him at the convention, and although Tip O'Neill was only in his 8th year in the House, he was, as a protege of Majority Leader John W. McCormick of Massachusetts, a rising figure there. He would one day be Speaker, and was already known as a congressman with connections beyond Massachusetts's borders. O'Neill, a congressman from Kennedy's own state, could not imagine what Johnson wanted, and when he found out what it was, he was astonished. After some small talk, O'Neill was to recall, Johnson said, Now I realize you're pledged to the boy, but you and I both know he can't win. He's just a flash in the pan, and he's got no record of substance to run on. Will you be with me on the second ballot? O'Neill knew nothing of the sort, and since he had already tangled with the Kennedys in Massachusetts, he tried to explain the situation. I said, Mr. Leader, let me tell you something. Jack Kennedy is going to be the nominee for president. He's going to win on the first ballot for several reasons. Because of the innovative methods the Kennedys use, the untold wealth they have, and the long arm of Joseph Kennedy. But Johnson, O'Neill realized, couldn't believe what he was hearing. You're a professional, he said. You know the boy can't win. He can and he will, O'Neill said. When we get to the convention, there won't even be a second ballot. As it happened, at the moment of the conversation, O'Neill's estimate of Kennedy's strength was slightly exaggerated. But Johnson, he saw, was unwilling to concede even that Kennedy had a chance. I could see that Johnson thought I was nuts, O'Neill recalls. Shaking his head at O'Neill's words, the leader said, Come on, Tip, you know better than that. That boy is going to die on the vine. I'm asking you for some aid and support in New England after he fails. O'Neill saw that he just couldn't imagine that Jack Kennedy was going to win. And then came the primaries. Johnson had been confident that the other candidates would kill each other off in those primaries, that Kennedy would win some, Symington perhaps one or two, Humphrey a few, including certainly the first one in which he took on Kennedy head-to-head, since it would be held on April 5th in his neighboring state of Wisconsin. Kennedy won Wisconsin, though his margin over Humphrey was not decisive, and more important, had come from Wisconsin's four predominantly Catholic congressional districts. Since Humphrey had won the state's four Protestant districts, the vote, as Theodore White reported, was read as a Catholic-Protestant split. It would convince none of the bosses who controlled the delegates of the East that Kennedy was a winner. The religious issue was more alive than ever. When on primary night one of Kennedy's sisters asked him, "What does it mean?" he replied, quietly yet bitterly, that "we have to do it all over again." A Humphrey victory in the next significant primary, West Virginia, on May 10th, would be taken as proof that Kennedy couldn't carry a heavily Protestant state. It would, White said, all but end John F. Kennedy's chance of nomination, because it would throw the nominating decision into the back rooms, exactly what Johnson had been hoping for. As Roland Evans and Robert Novak wrote in their widely syndicated Inside Report column, it would open up the party to a whole series of new arrangements and deals, a fluid situation tailored to Johnson's skills. Johnson began helping Humphrey in West Virginia, working through Senator Byrd, who put his organization behind the Minnesotan. Kennedy, realizing what was happening, paid a call on Johnson in the Taj Mahal on April 8th and asked him, according to Johnson's account, to get Bob Byrd out of West Virginia. Johnson said he had nothing to do with Byrd's activities. "I reminded him that this is Byrd's own state, and I couldn't get him out if I was foolish enough to try." A lot was riding on that state, and Johnson played the card that, thanks to Brown and Root, had been the ace in his hand for all his political life. His first campaign for Congress had been the most heavily financed congressional campaign in the history of Texas. His two campaigns for the Senate had been the most lavishly financed senatorial campaigns in the state's history. And now, in West Virginia, a state where politics was very much for sale, he played the money card again, pouring cash into the state on Humphrey's behalf. But it was to no avail. It was after West Virginia that Johnson said to Jim Rowe, "How the hell does Joe Kennedy move money around like that?" And, like the rest of Johnson's efforts, the money card was played too late. Television documentaries and telethons have to be produced in advance to be effective. Local organizations require time to be set up and financed. A last-minute half-hour statewide telephone call-in telethon for Humphrey, staged with almost no preparation at all, was embarrassing. Authentic, unscreened questions put the candidate on the defensive. The Kennedys held other cards, and in West Virginia they were played in a manner that cast a revealing light on Jack Kennedy's cool rationality. The ambassador had arranged for Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr. to campaign for his son, a masterstroke in itself, since President Roosevelt was idolized in the state. But as Doris Goodwin wrote, FDR, Jr. did not confine his role to nostalgia. The Kennedy campaign had provided him with documents allegedly showing that Humphrey had sought draft deferments during World War II, although in fact he had attempted to enlist in both the Army and the Navy, but had been rejected because of physical disabilities. Although FDR Jr. was reluctant to use the documents, Bobby insisted, and Roosevelt displayed them to audiences, implying that Humphrey had been a draft dodger by saying, "I don't know where he was in World War II." Humphrey made what he was to call repeated contacts with the Kennedys, proving the charge was untrue, but Roosevelt continued making it. Asked about this, Jack Kennedy said, "Any discussion of the war record of Senator Humphrey was done without my knowledge and consent, and I strongly disagree with the injection of this issue into the campaign," a statement which, notes one of his biographers, did not challenge the accuracy of what Roosevelt said. Goodwin was to write that, as Kennedy perfectly understood, the deed was already done. And in fact, FDR Jr. went on with the injections. FDR Jr. was later to call this maneuver the biggest political mistake he had ever made. After the campaign, he went to Humphrey's office and apologized, but Humphrey never forgave him. And they had the trump card. Jack Kennedy, his willingness to confront an issue and his ability, his unique gifts as an orator, in doing so. With the focus now more than ever on Kennedy's religion, polls in West Virginia, where only 5% of the population was Catholic, showed that the tide had turned to Humphrey. Kennedy's advisors were split on how to handle the issue, with most of his Washington staff telling him to avoid it because it was too explosive. Kennedy decided to meet it head-on. 2 days before the primary, on a paid telecast, he discussed in detail the importance of the separation of church and state. And then, looking directly into the camera as he spoke, he said, "So when any man stands on the steps of the Capitol and takes the oath of office of president, he is swearing to support the separation of church and state. He puts one hand on the Bible and raises the other hand to God as he takes the oath. And if he breaks his oath, he is not only committing a crime against the Constitution, for which the Congress can impeach him and should impeach him, but he is committing a sin against God." And at this point, as Theodore White describes it, John F. Kennedy raised his hand from an imaginary Bible, as if lifting it to God, and repeating softly said, "A sin against God, for he has sworn on the Bible." It was, White wrote, "the finest TV broadcast I have ever heard any political candidate make." During the remaining 2 days before the primary, every other card in the Kennedy deck was played as well. The money, the bands of brothers and sisters roving the state, the handsome, open-faced candidate on masterfully produced documentaries opening with a shot of a PT boat cutting through the waves. After the telecast in which Kennedy raised his hand to God, "with a rush, one could feel sentiment change," White recounts, and he took more than 60% of the West Virginia vote. Flying off to Maryland, where he had campaigning to do, for its primary was a week away, Kennedy said, "I think we have now buried the religious issue." He had buried Lyndon Johnson's hopes as well. When Johnson picked up the next morning's New York Times, he read that Washington heard the unmistakable sound of a bandwagon calliope today. There was a quote from New York City's Mayor Robert F. Wagner, who said he would do nothing which might interfere with Jack's candidacy. Johnson had been counting on support from New York, but the Times reported, "West Virginia's primary election victory appeared to have all but guaranteed Kennedy the bulk of that state's 114 votes." "Mr. Kennedy is beginning to take on an air of inevitability," James Reston wrote. "The road to victory in Los Angeles suddenly seemed free and clear to him," W.H. Lawrence chimed in. At a press conference, Johnson could not hide his dismay. In his hand was a statement George Reedy had prepared. "The West Virginia primary demonstrated that voters are not going to pick a candidate on the basis of an irrelevant issue such as how he worships his God." But he couldn't even look at it. To questions about the effect of Kennedy's victory, he replied only, "I don't know," or "I have nothing to say." Sarah McClendon, who had covered him for many years, was shocked at what she saw in his face. "He slumped further in his seat," she reported. "He had circles under his eyes and looked sad. He was much quieter than usual." And when, a few minutes later, he went into the Senate's Democratic cloakroom, the little knots of senators abruptly stopped talking. The senators had been saying that Kennedy had it locked up, that Lyndon Johnson had made a huge mistake by not campaigning. What he feared most was happening to him, even in this room in which he had for years reigned supreme, in this room in which, of all the rooms in the world, he had been most assured of respect. And then, when it was in effect too late, when his dream was all but dead, when his chances for the great prize were all but gone, Lyndon Johnson showed how much he had wanted it all along. By the morning after that sad press conference, he had pulled himself together, and during the 2 months remaining before the Democratic convention, he made a desperate lunge for the prize. With Humphrey effectively out of contention, Jim Rowe no longer had a candidate. Johnson had refused Rowe's offers of assistance for years. Now he telephoned Rowe, and Rowe said, "If you want some help, I will be delighted to help you." "Fine," Lyndon Johnson said. "I need all the help I can get." And now that he was no longer trying to conceal his ambition, the effort that he was willing to make in its service became visible. And although he was older now, the way he campaigned was a reminder of Ed Clark's remark that, "I never thought it was possible for anyone to work that hard." His days, as one reporter wrote, were all 18-hour days. As soon as the Senate adjourned on the Friday after the West Virginia primary, he flew to Indianapolis because the Indiana primary bound the state's delegates only on the first ballot. And Senator Vance Hartke had assured him again that if only he could hold on through that ballot, many of the delegates would switch from Kennedy to him on the second round. As the plane was passing over the Alleghenies on the way to Indiana, 10,000 feet up, Johnson tapped a reporter on the shoulder and pointed to a cluster of toy-size houses in a bend of a river. Morgantown, West Virginia. "See those houses yonder?" he said. "In those houses, like all over the country, there are people who want what is good for America. They are looking for leadership. They must have it." And for half an hour until the plane touched down, Johnson kept reminding the reporter that it was leadership that was needed, and that he was the Senate's leader, that he had proven he could lead. Leaving the plane, he held a press conference at the airport. "The American people are looking for leadership." Then a second, because some local reporters had missed the first, then gave a speech at the Indianapolis Gridiron Club dinner and met the delegates in a hotel suite afterwards. It was almost midnight before he stopped working on them, singly or in little groups, and climbed into a car to take him back to the plane. The conveyor was not equipped with a bed. Lady Bird urged him to close his eyes and nap in his seat, but there were other reporters to be told about the need for leadership. And as one of them wrote, as the plane thundered through the cloudy night, Johnson's voice never stopped. Lady Bird said, "Please." "I'll get my sleep on the ranch," Johnson replied. But after the plane finally landed at his airstrip at 4 o'clock in the morning, there wasn't much sleep. He was up very early Saturday making telephone calls, and the next day, Sunday, he headed back to Washington. And then on the next Friday, on the eve of a long Memorial Day weekend, after another week of long days as majority leader, he was convening the Senate promptly at 10 o'clock every morning now, and long strategy sessions every evening with his campaign team, he headed into the West for a 5-day speaking tour of 6 Western states, beginning with Iowa, where Governor Lovelace, whose invitations he had been rejecting for 2 years, had agreed to come out to the Des Moines airport and meet with him aboard the conveyor. Then he went on to Idaho Falls, where the mayor had declared Lyndon Johnson Day, saying, "This is the biggest day ever to happen to Idaho Falls." For more than 2 years he had been refusing every suggestion that he let Western office holders know he was a candidate. Now, when it was all but too late, he let them know. In the same Idaho Falls hotel suite in which, 3 months before, he had refused to give Tom Boise the assurance he required, Johnson was approached now by another key Idaho Democratic leader, Lieutenant Governor William E. Drevlo. "I can't say whether I'm with you or not because I don't know whether you're a candidate," Drevlo said. "Are you a candidate?" "You're damn right I am," Lyndon Johnson said. He asked Drevlo to join him on the rest of the tour, and Drevlo agreed. Then came Saturday, a day that, as one reporter described it, started in Idaho Falls, swept through Spokane, side-tripped to Coeur d'Alene, and ended in Pierre, South Dakota, at 3:30 a.m. When the conveyor landed at the little airport in Pierre, a cold, cutting wind was blowing, and it was dark, although there was the first faint pink smudge of dawn in the sky. And as the reporters filed down out of the plane, they saw, silhouetted black against that smudge, a big Texas Stetson. South Dakota's governor, Ralph Herseth, had come to the airport, and Johnson had bounded out of the plane to meet him. And as the journalists walked past on the tarmac, he was pumping the governor's hand, talking away, with the only expression on his face a broad, confident smile. If Lyndon Johnson was tired, he wasn't letting anyone know it. Not long before he left, Kennedy had given him an opening, and he charged through it. An American U-2 spy plane had been shot down over Russia, and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, demanding that President Eisenhower apologize, had broken up a scheduled summit conference. Criticizing Eisenhower for authorizing a flight when it would jeopardize the conference, Kennedy said that had he been president, he would have sent regrets to Khrushchev. Even as Kennedy was making his statement, the country was already rallying behind its president, as Americans had traditionally done in foreign affairs crises, and Johnson told his Western audiences that that was what they should do now. "I want our president to be successful in his dealings with foreign nations," he said. "If we get into trouble, it won't be our president who is in a jam, it will be our nation that is in a jam." Khrushchev was trying to divide the American people.